Good morning, good afternoon. I'm on the morning schedule, aren't I? So good afternoon. This is the Joint Committee of House and Senate Judiciary Committees. We're going to be doing informational hearings today as we have in, this week. We have a number of items. We're going to kind of break them into two components. What we're going to do is go ahead and start with House Bill 3054, which is dealing with the expungement or criminal setting aside of records. We've had an ongoing work group that has been meeting. They're going to give us a status report as to where things are at and why they would like to have some additional time. So Josh Marquis here. Josh, please come up. Gail Meyer. And I think that's all we have right now that are here. And if others, if I understand Doug Cooper may join us, and if he does, we'll get him up at the table too. So thank you both for being here. And who would like to start?
I'll go ahead and start. My name is Joshua Marquis. I'm the district attorney of Clatsop County. I've held that job for almost 20 years. And I did spend 2 years doing capital indigent defense, so probably the only one of the few lawyers who's been both a capital defense lawyer and a capital prosecutor. In any event, this bill and Chair Przanski, we do prefer it be called a set-aside or sealing bill. There is an expungement process for juveniles, and it's very important to understand that expungement means that. All you have to do is ask former DA Terry Gustafson, who was disbarred for not complying with the judge's order. The theory for juveniles is you literally wipe it out of existence. All the files are shredded. There is nothing left. But as Justice Lindy, and I never thought I'd be quoting him, but said in probably the seminal case on this, the purpose of the set-aside law 137225, which with all due respect is a elephant created by committee. It is one of the most incredibly confusing statutes, not just for citizens, but also for judges to understand. It's got exceptions, and then if it doesn't fall into this, it's that. It sets aside, and what that means is that allows a person, and this is key to reentry, to be able to say, honestly, no, I have not been convicted of a crime, or no, I have not been arrested. At the moment, it's tied to the pretty antiquated ABC felony. No B or A felony can be set aside. And so for about 2 years, Gail on behalf of OCDLA and myself on behalf of the ODAA, and we had two, each of us had two worker bees from Metro Public Defender, in my case a senior deputy from Multnomah and Clackamas counties, and we've tried to craft things that and I know Gail has one as an issue that they're concerned about that I think is a legitimate issue. It doesn't directly go to it, but it's a problem about technology and things like mugshots.com and places where you know, for-profit outfits basically say, we're going to run your mugshot. If you don't give us $50, we won't take it down. And there are some interesting First Amendment issues. But let me tell you why we're asking you to sort of let us go on for another 6 or 8 months. We came what we thought was a really good compromise product. And then, if it's any consolation, both of our executive committees told us, we don't like that, and we don't like this part and that part. And at that point, it was too late to go back and try to redo it. But just let me give you a very brief overview of what we're trying to do. Both sides have made major concessions. And there's three things I think are important. One is give judges more discretion in terms of looking at cases. For example, right now, a judge, from a prosecution standpoint, let's say somebody has 3 prior assault convictions and they get a felony assault for because they assault the same woman again and they're convicted. 3 years and a day after that 4th conviction, they can apply for a set-aside. And the only thing the judge is allowed to look at is their conduct after conviction. Not the crime itself, not if the woman is still, you know, limping around 3 years later. So one of the concerns is, why should violent felons get these records set aside? Now, then let's flip over to the other side, because there's injustice being wrought by people who can't get them. There is a prohibition for any traffic, any 800 ORS series. So someone with a 1987, and this is not hypothetical, these happen a lot, and there are, I would guess, probably thousands of people like this. They have a FDWS conviction, and they have it from 87 when you could get one for having 27
felony driving while suspended.
Felony driving while suspended, 27 moving violations. And theoretically, you could go to prison for this, although it didn't happen very often. But it can't be taken off. So you have this person who can't own a firearm, can't, you know, maybe become a teacher. And that just doesn't seem right. Even bigger issue has to do with drugs. Based on the scheduling of drugs, possession of controlled substance of methamphetamine and cocaine, believe it or not, are prescribable drugs. And as a result, conviction for those offenses are Class C felonies. They can be and are set aside. Possession of heroin, on the other hand, or ecstasy, psilocybin, but heroin's the big one, cannot be, ever, because they're Class B felonies. And I'll let Gail speak to it, but it's clearly an enormous bar to reentry. I mean, if you have a Class B felony and you can't get it set aside and you have to write, you know, possession of heroin, you can just imagine, and there are people who have gotten clean and, you know, done the work, and overcoming a heroin addiction is no small thing. So in terms of numbers, for example, and I think Gail would agree with me on this, what we're talking about literally thousands of people for felony driving while suspended in PCS. Probably a much smaller number on the flip side, and it isn't just as simple of trading one for the other. There, the devil is always in the details, and that's what we'd like to work out. We think, I'm trying to, when does the even numbered year session begin?
February,
and it lasts 2 months?
One month.
Okay. Well, if we did our homework and could deliver a product that could, my guess would be that the committees would welcome something that had the endorsement of both the OCDLA and the ODAA. And we think that, I think Gail and I, and she'll certainly speak better for herself, are within the grasp of doing that. And she's going to talk about mugshots.com and the ancillary, the not LexisNexis and not newspapers, but basically for-profit operations that run data mills and then don't update them. Now, there are some interesting First Amendment issues, but I think that is a problem. And if, you know, I argue for truth in sentencing. Well, if somebody got their record set aside, it should show as being set aside.
Yeah. Thank you. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I concur and agree with Mr. Marquis's assessment. We had some really dedicated, true-hearted worker bees down in the trenches trying to do the negotiations, and they came up out of the trenches and presented a work product, and both of our executive legislative committees went down, as I know those who have been on the Public Safety Commission can heartily agree with. But it's tough work. It's tough work. But we're not that far apart. The problem for OCDLA really is it's not so much anymore the statutory terms of expungement. Nobody goes to the courthouse anymore to pull the records to see if there's a conviction. What they do is they get on the internet and they do a records check through a company, and that company extracts a fee and they give them the results of some data. The problem is that company may have extracted conviction information but then never simply updated it when the conviction was set aside 3 years later. So every time OCDLA tries to come up with a fix to that, there's a problem to our fix, because there's federal laws, there's the Federal Credit Reporting Act, which actually applies here in some respects. It preempts state laws. It's a conundrum for us. We still seek the solution. But I do like to concur with Mr. Marquis. I think that the expungement statute, as it reads today, is a bit of a Frankenstein monster. It's been chewed up, eaten up, cobbled up, disemboweled, reattached together, and it needs to have a more cohesive structure to it. So I hope we can still continue on the extract the cooperation of our worker bees to get back at it, but we think hopefully sometime by February we might be able to produce something.
Thank you very much. What I'm going to ask, though, I think February is really too late if we're going to actually do something in February. If at all possible, if you could shoot for the end of the year, and that way we could actually have something drafted to be considered.
Right.
what would be great, if you think you can get there, I'm not sure, I don't have the interim schedule, but I believe we have dates in either late November or 1st of December for a set of meetings. And if you could check with council, if you could strive for that, maybe we can get an update. Well, just to see where you're at, understanding that.
Chair Przanski, one of the things, since what we need to do is overcome, as you may recall, the DA's Association meets twice a year, and they meet always. And so, in other words, I know when I can get them all together and get them sign off on it. And that would be, I'd have to look at a calendar, but it would be probably the 3rd, 4th, or 5th of December. And I understand, you know, we can't wait until the session, and then it's got to be a pre-cooked and pre-approved product.
Yeah,
probably by the end of 2013.
Yeah, I mean, the reality, I think, as you both realize, being seasoned veterans for this building, knowing that we have only 35 days, if you don't have things pretty well loaded up, our first week, if it's not out of whichever committee it originates in for that chamber, it's no longer going to be even considered because it will be too late. So if y'all really, I mean, y'all put a lot of work into this. Thank you very, very much for all the work and for the worker bees that have been involved. I agree with the assessments. This is one of the most onerous set the statutes as to page after page with overlay, exemptions, blah, blah, blah. So any questions, other comments, Senator Robles?
Yeah, I just want to ask Gail if she meant the set-aside statutes or the expungement statutes, because she said expungement, and I heard set-aside earlier, so I was just trying to check which ones.
Senator Przanski, Chair Przanski, Senator Roblin, set-aside statute. Statute. In common parlance amongst practitioners, we always refer to it as expungement, but I agree with Mr. Marquis that technically that's a term that you employ for juvenile adjudications.
Set aside. Any other comments? So, Josh, is it all right? Take away from today, I have you quoted saying, "Give judge more discretion."
I did hear that.
I was going to go on about sentencing. Even
you will never hear the end of that.
Thank you all very much. Is anyone else that was scheduled to be coming forward? That was Doug Cooper, and we may have had someone that was going to come in, unknown invitee for Washington County Reentry Council. If they're not here, we're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing at this point. And I think what we'll do is we're going to go ahead and load up all three next. Anna, Bill, who's taking the lead on these? I just want to make sure. I think I'm going to open it up for all three. We can call the judge, you said, in any time between 1:30 and 2. Should we take his?
I think he would be grateful if he could do his first.
All right, so if we'll get Branford on the phone, and then we will go from there. So I'll go ahead and open up a informational hearing on Senate Bill 812, and also, if it should be appropriate, Senate Bill 789 and 799, 798 and 799 at this point. And...
letting you do that by yourself, Floyd?
We'll find out.
I get first try.
Oh, good job.
Hasn't worked yet.
Hello, Judge Branford?
Yes.
Hi, Judge Branford. This is Floyd Przanski. I'm the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have you on phone, speakerphone, in the hearing. Joining us is the House Chair and other committee members for both of the committees. Jeff Barker is chairing for the House. Welcome, and thank you very much for taking time out of your day. And what we need you to do, if you'd be so kind, sir, is to give us your name and then your testimony. We understand that you will be talking about affidavit-ing, removal of judges from consideration as judges for a particular case.
Yes, and first thank you very much for letting me testify by phone. I appreciate it very much, and I'm glad to be able to testify. My name is Tom Branford, B-R-A-N-F-O-R-D. I'm a judge in Newport and have been for 24 years. I was Steve Reed from Columbia County, and a senator from Columbia County actually drafted this bill. They were the brainchild behind it, and Russ West found out about it next. He's the presiding judge in LeGrand, and sent out an email to all the judges in the smaller counties, and I was thrilled to hear this proposal was being considered. I had written a letter in April that I'm not sure how many of the senators and representatives who are there may have read, but do I have 5 or 10 minutes?
Yes, sir, you do. We have, just to give you a point of reference, the House is going back onto the floor at 2 o'clock. We have two other bills that are kind of adjacent to this, but yeah, if you took 5 to 10 minutes, you'd be fine.
All right, I'll try to move right along. First of all, let me say that it's extremely important that judicial proceedings be fair and that litigants perceive that it's fair. I have no question about that premise at all. Oregon currently has several protections to litigants to make sure they get a fair trial. One of them is ORS 14.210, which prohibits a judge from serving on a case in a variety of circumstances. And if there are certain relationships or certain circumstances that exist, there's an affirmative duty on judges to take themselves off the case without any action on the part of the litigant or the litigant's attorney. There's a second procedure under 14.260 where either an attorney or the litigant can say, I just don't think I can get a fair trial in front of this judge. And if that happens, the judge is simply effectively required to remove himself or herself because the burden is on the judge to prove that the person isn't wrong about the premise that the judge can't be fair. It's like proving the negative. So judges simply don't contest it statewide. If an affidavit of prejudice is filed, judges simply take themselves off the case. The trouble in the real world is that while 14.260 is intended to protect litigants against an abusive judge, it's used as a sword, not a shield, by a good number of lawyers. When I say a good number of lawyers, step back from that. Most lawyers, in my experience, have never filed an affidavit of prejudice, ever. Some may file one or two in an entire career of 35 or 40 years. What happens in reality is that there is a small number of attorneys who file these affidavits in virtually every case they have, where they're angling to try to get a judge whom they think will be most favorable to their client in the case. And it is that practice that really amounts to judge shopping. Some judges are appointed by the governor, but ultimately you have to be elected. And so the bulk of the judges have been elected by the constituents in that judicial district. And along comes the litigant and says, no, I don't like that one, and I don't like that one either. And in a small jurisdiction, that works profoundly in a negative way. First, if there are three judges total, what they can do is angle for the one judge of the three whom they think will be most favorable to their side of the case. And that's what is called judge shopping. And, for example, I have an affidavit here with me where, although an attorney could do it himself or herself, this was done just 2 weeks ago, where there was an email from the defense lawyer to the judicial assistant for the judge who had been assigned the case and said, hey, I'm going to meet with my client in a few days. We haven't talked yet, but they've called me by phone to hire me, and we're going to file an affidavit of prejudice against the judge and get a new judge on the case. Well, that was followed up 4 or 5 days later by an affidavit signed by the litigant who said he didn't think the judge could be fair. But it had nothing to do with the litigant. The lawyer does this on behalf of all the clients they have when it comes to a particular one or two judges. And that's why I say it is typically borne by attorneys who are angling for a favorable result. And that's what I think is an abuse of the statute. There is the Oregon Judicial Code holds judges to high standards, as it should. But under the Oregon Judicial Code, there are requirements that in the absence of any statutory provision at all, if you think that a person reasonably believes you couldn't be fair, you have to take yourself off the case. And that drives a lot of judges to simply decline handling a case when there's any question about impartiality or propriety of that judge handling the case. And so there is that additional layer of protection for litigants to make sure they are getting a fair judge. Ultimately, it ends up costing the taxpayers money that it shouldn't when two challenges are exercised, because in small counties, typically that means a judge from a different jurisdiction has to be brought in, and that involves travel expenses, per diem expenses, and lodging for the judge for the duration of the trial. And so ultimately, the taxpayers foot the bill for what amounts to game playing by one of the attorneys. And that's an expense the taxpayer shouldn't have to bear. I mentioned also in the letter I wrote in early April, just for perspective, just for contrast, in both Washington and in California, attorneys and or their client may file only one challenge against the judge in any case, no matter the size of the judicial district. So in L.A. and San Diego and San Francisco and Seattle and Spokane, they only get one challenge, period. And so I'm suggesting that at least as to the small counties in Oregon, having only one challenge is not a novel concept, and it's one that seems to work rather well in those two states and could well work well here. And I should have prefaced my remarks by saying that I do not speak on behalf of the Judicial Department. I'm speaking only on behalf of the 22 judges in the smaller districts in Oregon who have publicly endorsed this bill. And so please don't attribute any of my remarks to OJD, because they shouldn't be. And I'm open for questions at this point. I know your time is limited.
All right. Judge Ranford, thank you very much. Let me go ahead and see if there are any questions for you before we take other testimony. We do have Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge Ranford, nice to talk to you again. You may recall, sir, when you testified very briefly in front of the House Judiciary Committee, that I and some of my colleagues were simply astonished, given that I have never affidavited a judge and hope to never do so in my career. To find that, as you put it, this is being used as a sword instead of a shield. I've looked into it since then, and indeed, it seems that a small number of actors are doing this. Allow me to say that I simply think this is an outrageous practice, especially in a small county with only three judges. I'm astonished. I didn't even know it could be done. I cannot believe that this loophole exists, and I think it is entirely appropriate that we act. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Judge, tell us how often this has happened in your county.
It happens with some frequency with particular judges. Statistically, I'm sorry, I didn't get raw numbers, because it varies. But again, let me say, I get affidavited off cases, and it never, ever bothers me. Because people are entitled to have a fair trial and to believe they're going to get a fair trial. And if I have given a person, say, a harsh sentence or a tough sentence before, they might think that I'm too tough. And if they do, from the outset, they ought to get a fresh start with somebody. So I don't have a problem with it. Affidavits are filed with some frequency, and it never bothers me when it comes from attorneys who don't abuse the statute, ever. Luckily, I haven't been the target of many manipulative challenges in the past, but I've known other judges who are, and it has been profoundly clear when they were angling for a different judge by who they challenged, and clearly done in a tactical way. And I'm sorry, I'm not answering your question, because you asked for numbers. I can tell you that Russ West in Union County, in his testimony, said that something over 1,000 challenges had been filed in Union County in the last couple of years, which is just an outrageous number for a county that has only two judges.
That's helpful. Thank you very much, Judge.
Any other questions for Your Honor? Judge Branford, we're going to go ahead and take other testimony. You're more than welcome to stay on the phone if you'd like. If not, then we will disconnect. Your choice. And if you need to, if you want to stay on but need to disconnect, go ahead, and I think it will let us know when that happens.
All right, and thank you very much for giving me this chance. I'd like to listen because I'm not sure what somebody else may offer. So,
okay.
Thank you very much.
What I'm going to be doing is calling up Susan Graby and Judge Janache. At this point, they will be talking on 798 and 799. And I think Susan may also have some other comments for 812. And it looks like Gail Meyer may be joining them as well. So, Your Honor, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Members of the committee. I'm Judge Charles Zanashi. I'm a circuit court judge in Lane County. I want to preface all of my comments by the statements I'm about to make are my own personal views and not those of the Oregon Judicial Department. Senator Przanski was kind enough to sponsor two bills on my behalf or at my request. The first was Senate Bill 798. The -2 version was the one that we were talking about. That bill addresses two different issues. First, the bill addresses the manner in which alternate jurors are selected in criminal cases. Second, it gives trial judges the authority to substitute alternate juror for a juror who dies or become ill or otherwise unable to complete deliberations. Both of these changes mirror changes that have been approved by the Council on Court Procedure to Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure 57, which governs the selection of jurors in civil cases. Currently, under Oregon law, the law requires that alternate jurors be selected after the jury panel is impaneled and sworn. What that means is that judges have to generally swear in the jury under the statute, swear in the jury, and then select alternates. Many judges around the state are not doing that because judges and lawyers think that, to some extent, that telegraphing to jurors that they are alternates might lead them to not pay as much attention as they might otherwise if they didn't know that. So judges and juries, lawyers are generally not doing that. They're not following a statutory procedure, even though there's no authority for that other than the consent of the parties. So what we were seeking to do was to change the law to give the trial judge express authority to use different methods for the selection of alternate jurors. The second change that Senate Bill 792-2 was making to existing law was to allow the trial judge to replace a juror who dies, becomes ill, or is otherwise unable to complete deliberations with an alternate juror who sat through the entire case. Under the current law, a judge is required to discharge alternate jurors when the jury begins its deliberations. The only exception to that is a situation where the defendant is to be tried on enhancement factors, and that exception is allowed only in that case. So under the current law, if you've had a multi-week trial and you charge the jury, I'll say on a Friday afternoon after closing argument, and over the weekend a juror gets ill or gets in a car wreck, come Monday morning, you are down one juror and you have no mechanism for replacing that juror because you've had to discharge the alternate jurors. That leads to potentially great expense on behalf of the state and the people of the state. The alternate jurors have sat through the entire trial. So the second change we were recommending, or I was recommending, was to allow the court the authority to replace the alternate juror or the juror who became ill with an alternate juror, and give the court the discretion. And the parties would have an opportunity to raise objections to that if they felt the deliberations had gone too far, but that was to give the judge that discretion. The Senate bill, I'm going to quickly address Senate Bill 799 as well. The -1 amendment, we thought it was primarily a housekeeping matter. It was intended to make clear that a lawyer may withdraw from a case, may not withdraw from a case without permission of the court only, and may only do so without permission of the court when there's another lawyer taking over the case. Currently, ORS 9380 allows lawyers to withdraw from a case under two circumstances, either with the permission of the court or, quote, upon the consent of the attorney, close quote. The second option, I believe, is intended to allow counsel to withdraw when a new lawyer is taking over the case and consents to that withdrawal. Unfortunately, some lawyers have taken a position that they can consent to their own withdrawal, and that creates an unworkable and untenable situation for courts. You have the problem of, especially in criminal cases, where a criminal defendant facing the eve of trial with a potential significant sanction requests their lawyer to withdraw, and if the lawyer can simply consent to that withdrawal at the direction of their client, they probably have an ethical obligation to do that, they would be able to withdraw on the eve of trial and it would turn over control of our dockets to others. So we were asking just to clarify that issue. There were some concerns raised by the Oregon Defense Lawyers Association. They asked for a chance to look at on Senate Bill 798-2. I'll just briefly summarize. At least look at the second part of that bill, the replacement of an alternate juror replacement of a juror who becomes ill with an alternate juror. You know, under the federal system, they don't replace jurors, they simply use less of them. So there was some discussion, maybe we could have a work group to discuss that option. I don't think, and perhaps Ms. Graby can, Ms. Meyer can address it more directly, but I had the sense from them that they weren't really concerned about the first part of the bill, which gave the court discretion over the mechanism of selection of alternate jurors. The other change with regard to 799, I think that the bar had some concerns about that, and I think we're prepared, to, if necessary, to do a work group on both these bills in the off session.
Who would like to go next?
Have you talked about 812 yet?
Yes. Judge Banford.
Thank you. Oh, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, thank you for the opportunity to make comments on these bills. With respect to Senate Bill 798, that's the one on the alternate juror. I'm pleased that this is going to be receiving some considered debate and input. There's 49 other states that have the same problem, and the federal court system has the same problem, and it'd be interesting to see what they decided. The federal system consciously chose to not introduce alternate jurors midway through the deliberation process. They questioned its wisdom. They questioned its constitutionality. And so I'm mindful of that. And they've done some looking at it, and it seemed to me that that ought to render caution and pause before we proceeded in just adopting that point of view. The federal system instead says the court can compel the defendant to go to verdict with just 11 jurors. We're quite clear we don't think that's constitutional under the Oregon Constitution. So we don't know if we're between a hard rock and a hard place or what, but we just thought it was important to look at what 49 other states do, figure out why the feds walked away from it, and figure out, just have a more deliberative discussion about that. So we're happy for that opportunity. With respect to Senate Bill 812, which is the motion with respect to more than one limiting in smaller judicial districts the option for an affidavit to just one motion, boy, did we hear a lot of feedback from our members on that one. That was the instance when retired Judge Milo Pope drove all the way out here from Baker City to talk to the committee about that. And that was the day we had horse-tripping hearings. And so Mr. Pope had all of 4 minutes to talk to the committee. But he came out here, he came a long way, because he really wanted to talk to this committee about that bill. And my understanding is he's offered himself up to participate with the state bar. This doesn't look the same to everybody in different shoes. And so we think a robust discussion is in order. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Susan?
Thank you very much. Susan Graby, Public Affairs Director with the Oregon State Bar, Chair Prozonsky, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm here simply to say that we're happy we've been asked to coordinate and facilitate work groups on these three bills, Senate Bill 798, Senate Bill 799, and Senate Bill 812. We are more than happy to do that during the interim. And Chair Prozonsky, the timing issue is one that we probably need more direction from you on. Currently, the bar has two existing work groups, or excuse me, advisory committees to our Board of Governors. The Judicial Administration Committee, which has some judges on it and practitioners from all different parts of the state. currently chaired by Vanessa Nordyke and Secretary Rod Bouteen. And then we have, and they deal with judicial administration issues. Procedure and Practice Committee deals with all the procedural issues and practice issues that come up, and we're happy to have these three bills go to the appropriate work group, 798 and 799, probably to Procedure and Practice Committee, which we would then augment with a few additional practitioners, particularly in the criminal law arena on both sides of the fence, as well as another judge or two, depending on what the preference of the committee is. And we're happy to do the same thing on Senate Bill 812. I think that Judge Zanashi is correct. Their the Council on Court Procedures did promulgate rules on the alternate juror side for the civil side, but I do think it bears further exploration with criminal law practitioners both from both sides of the fence.
Okay. Questions? Comments? I think it's fine. Susan, I from my perspective, understand because of the voluntariness of the committees and stuff, it may not be something that can happen really quick. But if things can move forward, that we can consider it in February, so be it. But if that's not the case, we definitely would like to have something back to us during our second interim before we would be getting ready for the 2015 regular session. And my preference would be not to impose upon the bar any guidelines of how to do the work group, but based on what you put on the record, it does seem like there'd be multiple opportunities for participants who are interested parties and practitioners, as well as judges to be part of those work groups that are in addition to whatever you may already have within those existing members of the work groups. So, any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. I want to thank everyone for having taken the opportunity to be here. We do have one individual who showed up on the first informational hearing we had, which was, is it Doug Cooper? I have that down as Deputy Director for Mercy Corps Northwest. Please feel free to come forward. I'm going to go ahead and reopen. I'll close the informational hearing on 798, 799, and 812. And reopen for the purpose of taking additional testimony on House Bill 3054. And just to let you know, time-wise, the House members are going to be leaving to go to the floor at 2 o'clock. Or in any moment, they may be stepping out. Don't think they're not here to listen to you.
Okay.
But the speakers told them they had to go back to work on the floor.
Thank you. Members, thank you for hearing us this evening.
Yes.
Judge Branford, I'm hanging up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge Branford. Have a great day.
Excuse me, Senator. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right.
Dumb.
That's quite all right. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Really.
My name is Doug Cooper. I'm the Deputy Director at Mercy Corps Northwest in Portland, Oregon. We are also responsible for the Reentry Transition Center, which sees about 1,000 people coming out of incarceration within their first 2 years of incarceration each year. We're here to speak primarily about the human face of expungement and two things in particular, the motivation for a potential expungement for the people that we see and the people we work with every day. And second of all, about the basic fairness to people who have done what they've needed to do, have paid their price, have changed their lives, are productive members of society, and continue to pay the penalty of a felony in their past, which I know it's no news to you, but makes it more difficult to find good jobs, good housing. It actually is counterproductive to everything that we're hoping will happen when they enter a penitentiary or a correctional facility. And the opportunity to see that change and for us to, essentially to see a modicum of fairness established in the system. If we've held them accountable for their transgressions and they paid the price, it also seems like there's accountability on our part to recognize their good work after they have changed their lives and are making contributions to lift that burden from them. I've never experienced it. I only see it from an administrative point of view. With me is Alberta McCoy, who is one of our two navigators at the Reentry Transition Center. Alberta, to me, is I brought her for two reasons. First of all, she sees it day to day. She works directly with the people that we work with. She knows what motivates them. And secondly, she's had a felony conviction in her past. She's lived it. To me, she's a perfect example of why she should be able to not have her have to worry again about convictions that she had earlier in her career, because she's an exemplary person and has helped a tremendous number of people after she chose to change her life.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon. I definitely believe that there should be
Alberta,
some...
I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Alberta McCoy.
Yeah.
And I work with the Reentry Transition Center as a navigator.
Okay. And just to let everyone know, you'll see a lot of people leaving now. These are our House members that are going back to that House floor to vote and take care of business. But the senators will stay. And thank you very much for being here.
Sorry. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. I have been formally incarcerated, and I do agree that there does need to be some type of motivation for people who are actively deciding to change their lives. And by that, I mean they need to be able to look on the other side and say, you know, I can achieve a dream. This is still America. There is still something great here happening for me, that when I decide to make the right choice and become a taxpaying citizen and be able to move beyond the things I did, that we don't have to continue to be reconvicted. And as speaking for myself, it's been since 1989, and I still get that. You know, I still get, you can't come in here, you can't do this because of your prior convictions, even though I've paid for them. And if there was some kind of way that I could get the felonies off of my record, you know, where I can continue to move forward and be a very prominent person of society, I would definitely appreciate it. So I'm kind of stuck where I know what their pain is, and I still feel it. But there has to be some way that when we get out, that we don't have to continue to be sentenced and resentenced over and over.
Well, thank you. Let me see if there's any questions. What I want to say is that, you know, for an individual such as yourself that has now 24 years of, quote-unquote, clean record without having other criminal episodes, it's very important for me and I think for the rest of the committee to do what we can to assist you and others that have basically start living the quality of life that we would want all individuals to have. And your work that you're doing now is very, very important, because I think just you being a role model for many people that you are working with directly now gives them hope and understanding that they can also make the achievements that you have. But I will tell you that the work group that's ongoing regarding set-asiding criminal convictions as well as expungements in the juvenile area will continue to work. We've asked them to get back to us before hopefully the end of this year. So if they're able to get resolution within their work group, that we will have a legislation to bring forward during the short session in February of next year. If that's not possible, our goal is to then have it ready for the next regular session, which will be starting in January of 2015. So please stay with us and give us a little bit more time. Let the work group conclude its work, and then we, the legislature, will have an opportunity to review it and hopefully support all of it or make some modifications if we feel that's necessary. But thank you very much. Any other comments? Thank you very much for coming in today. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing on House Bill 3054, and that concludes the work that we have as a committee, and so we'll close the informational hearings for both the Senate and the House Judiciary Committees. And I do believe we have some that are scheduled for next week for committee members and those who are following. Please check the record as to dates and times and subject matter.